All right, so let's jump right into this deep dive. Today we're going to be untangling what I think is a pretty fascinating legal knot, the case of State Department of Transportation v. Providence and Western Railroad.
Yeah, this one really, it brings together a lot of different areas of law. It's not just a simple contract dispute. It's also about state power, about what exactly we mean by rail property. You know, it all gets pretty interesting.
Right. And it's from 1985, which, might sound a while back, but the core issues are still relevant today. I mean, how do we balance private deals with what's good for the public, especially when it comes to things like infrastructure, right?
Yeah.
That's always going to be a question.
Absolutely. And this case gives us a great example of how the courts try to work through that. So at the heart of it, we have a dispute over Rhode Island's right to buy some railroad property before it went to another company. Like, did they have the power to sort of jump the line?
Right, like a right of first refusal, kinda. But it gets more complicated than that, right? Because we have to look at what makes an acceptance of an offer legit, especially when it's the government doing the accepting. And then there's the whole question of what exactly is rail property, legally speaking?
Exactly. And then there's the practical question of money, too. Does the state have to have the cash right there to make their right to buy stick? I mean, government moves slowly, right?
Yeah.
So there are a lot of layers here.
Okay, so before we get lost in the legal weeds, let's set the scene. So rewind back to 1982. The Providence and Worcester Railroad, P&W for short, they buy this piece of land in Rhode Island from Conrail. It's about 7 acres. Sounds pretty standard so far, right?
It does, but there's a catch. See, this sale came with a special court order attached. P&W had to keep providing rail service on this land for at least 4 years. They couldn't just buy it and, turn it into a parking lot or something right away.
Okay, so that little detail is going to come back to bite them, huh?
You bet it will. So fast forward to 1985. P&W wants to sell this land. They find a buyer, a company called Promit Corp, but here's where they made their misstep. They didn't offer it to the state of Rhode Island first.
And that's when Rhode Island throws a flag on the play.
Yeah.
Right? They're saying, hold on, we have a law here. It's section 39-6.19, and it gives us the right of first refusal on any rail property.
Mm.
So in their eyes, P&W went behind their back, basically.
Precisely. Their argument is that P&W was obligated to offer it to them first. And this is where the whole case hinges, right?
So this goes to trial, right?
Yeah.
And what happens? Does the court side with P&W or with the state?
Well, the trial court actually did something interesting. They voided the sale to Promet, meaning they sided with Rhode Island. But they also said Rhode Island had to pay interest on the purchase price, which was $100,000.
So a bit of a split decision there.
Yeah, neither side was totally happy, so they both appealed. Rhode Island wasn't thrilled about the interest, and P&W, well, they probably just wanted to sell the land to Promet, period.
So off to the Rhode Island Supreme Court it goes. All right, so now the Supreme Court has this case, and they're looking at a few really knotty legal issues. The first one is, what exactly does it mean for the state to say yes to the offer? Like, what counts as a valid acceptance? P&W is arguing that when Rhode Island tried to accept, they added in some extra stuff that messed it up.
Right. They're focusing on this letter from the state. They mentioned changing the buyer's name to, well, the state of Rhode Island. Which seems pretty obvious, but okay. And then it said something about removing the tracks. P&W latched onto that and said, see, that's not just accepting, that's changing the deal. It's a counteroffer.
But the court wasn't convinced, were they?
Not at all. They said these changes were immaterial. In other words, they didn't fundamentally change the offer. They were just clarifying details.
So it's like, okay, duh. The state of Rhode Island's buying it. And if they're buying it and there's no more rail service needed, well, yeah, the tracks got to go somewhere, right?
Exactly. The court wasn't going to let P&W get off on a technicality. They looked at the big picture. There's this legal principle, right? And acceptance has to be definite and unequivocal. You can't be wishy-washy. But the court also acknowledged that sometimes you got to read between the lines a bit. They even quoted a legal precedent saying, it is not equivocation if the offeree merely puts into words that which was already reasonably implied in the terms of the offer.
So basically, common sense prevailed.
Pretty much. The court said, look, everyone knew what the deal was. These extra details didn't change that. It's only when you have a material change, something that really alters the core of the offer, that it becomes a counteroffer.
Gotcha. So point one for the state. Now, issue number two. This is where it gets interesting, I think. The whole definition of rail property. P&W's argument was, even though the tracks were there, the land wasn't really being used for rail service at that moment, so it wasn't rail property anymore.
Yeah, they were trying to get really technical with the wording of the statute. They're saying current use is what matters, but the court looked beyond that.
So what convinced the court that it was still rail property, even though trains weren't running on it at that exact moment.
Two big things. First, remember that special court order from back in 82, the one saying PNW had to keep rail service going for 4 years? That was still in effect. So legally speaking, this land was tied to rail operations. And second, the tracks were physically there. It's not like it was just an empty field with a railroad crossing sign, you know.
So the court's saying just because a train isn't running right this second doesn't mean it's not rail property. They're looking at its potential, its legal status, the whole picture.
Exactly. And I think this is a really important point for anyone dealing with, you know, statutes and legal definitions. The court's not just looking at the literal right now situation. They're considering the context, the history, the potential, especially when you're talking about something like infrastructure, which has public implications.
Right. Because otherwise companies could just like shut down operations for a bit and say, oh, it's not real property anymore. We can sell it to whoever we want.
Precisely. So the court's being careful there. Okay, now, on to issue number three. This one's about time frames. Specifically, that 30-day window that Rhode Island had to exercise their right of first refusal.
Ah, so the question is, did they just have to say yes within 30 days, or did they also have to hand over the $100,000 within that time?
Right. Did the clock start ticking on the payment as soon as they accepted? And this is important because government, as we know, it doesn't always move at lightning speed.
So what did the court decide? Did they have to pay up right away?
Nope. They ruled that the state only had to accept within the 30 days. Once they'd done that, they had a reasonable amount of time to actually make the payment. It's like, you know, you agree to buy a house. You don't hand over the entire sum the second you shake hands, right? There's escrow, paperwork, all that.
Makes sense. So score another one for Rhode Island, right?
Well, not so fast. There's a bit of a twist at the end. Remember the trial court said Rhode Island had to pay interest on that $100,000?
Oh, yeah. What happened with that?
The Supreme Court overturned that part. They brought up the idea of state immunity. States have certain legal protections. One of them is that they're usually not liable for what's called prejudgment interest. That's interest that builds up before a final judgment is made.
So it's like, unless Rhode Island specifically said, yeah, we'll pay interest, or there's a law forcing them to, they're off the hook.
Exactly. And the court was very clear about this. They said prejudgment interest does not apply to judgments against the state unless explicitly waived. So basically, if you're dealing with a state government and you want interest, you better get it in writing.
Gotcha. So a win for Rhode Island in the end.
Yeah.
But this whole case, it's not just about who won or lost, mm-hmm. right? It's about these bigger legal principles. What are some of the key takeaways, especially for someone, you know, going through law school right now?
Well, first of all, this case shows how seriously courts take these rights of first refusal, especially when it comes to things that impact the public, like infrastructure. If a law gives the state that right, they're going to uphold it. So if you're ever advising a client who's dealing with something similar, you got to keep that in mind.
Right. Don't mess with the state's right to buy, basically.
Pretty much. And then there's the contract law side of it. This whole question of what makes an acceptance valid. It seems simple. But as we saw, there can be these little nuances. The court's not going to throw out a deal just because someone clarified a minor detail, but they're also not going to let people slip in major changes under the guise of acceptance.
So be precise, but also use common sense when drafting and reviewing contracts.
Exactly. And then finally, there's that state immunity wrinkle. States are not like regular people or companies in the eyes of the law. They have special protections, and you got to be aware of those.
But yeah, tons of stuff to learn from this case, even though it's from a few decades back. It really shows how law is this mix of like strict rules and practical considerations.
Yep.
Absolutely. You've got statutes to interpret, contracts to analyze, and then you've got these bigger principles of government power and individual rights. It all gets woven together.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into State Department of Transportation v. Providence and Worcester Railroad, we've seen how courts wrestle with these questions of what makes a yes, what defines a piece of property, and how the state is different from, well, everyone else in a legal sense.
And I think it leaves us with a really interesting question to ponder. You know, how might the outcome of this case shape the way state governments and private companies deal with each other in the future, especially when it comes to important infrastructure? Like, how do we balance public needs with private rights? It's a question that's not going away anytime soon.
Definitely something to think about. All right, well, that's it for our deep dive today. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
See you then.